It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Alex Kaplan of Common Cause about the money that is just flowing all over the natural gas industry and into the hands of our state legislators and what it means to our system. How has this influence of cash corrupted our system? I think it's done more harm than it could ever do good. And at some point, we've got to start looking at publicly financed elections. Come on. I think everybody knows what the solution is here. The solution is to take the big money out of it and put in small donors. You know, people who throw in $5, $10, give it back to the people. Go back, undo this Citizen United's decision. This has been a horrible decision. And again, you know, you look at who's on the Supreme Court, you look at who put them there. This is a conservative Supreme Court, and there are some interesting cases that are popping up right now we're going to talk about later in the program. But before we get to any of that, I want to talk about teachers today. Because last week a decision came down here in the state of Pennsylvania that home addresses of all teachers in the state of Pennsylvania are part of the right to know. So you have the right to know where your teacher lives. And to me, this is another one of those daggers in the heart of public education. Because how are you going to get people who, you know, for the low pay that they get to begin with? And thanks to Matt Briette over at the Commonwealth Foundation, the Tea Party think tank, as I like to call it. Thanks to him, I now can go on and see just how little teachers in my school district actually make. I mean, before they were saying, well, these teachers make big, big money. I'm looking down the list with a master's degree. Some people are making $30,000 and $35,000 a year with a master's degree. I know people who are swinging a hammer making twice that. I know people sitting behind the wheel of a truck making more than twice that. You're not going to tell me our most precious resource, the children who are going to take care of me when I'm old, are not worth more than $30,000, $35,000 a year to someone who has a master's degree and who has committed their life to educating our children. And all we keep hearing from the little tinky tanks like the Commonwealth Foundation and these other right-wing nutcases is, oh, we need to privatize education. We need charter schools, and we need faith-based schools and Christian schools. Yet no studies have shown me anything that these charter schools or these Christian schools or any of these do better than public education. They haven't shown me that. Maybe in instances where you're plucking kids out of horrible situations and putting them into another environment. The Milton Hershey School here in the area is a prime example of going into a community where there's economic devastation, there's mass poverty, and they pluck that kid out and they take that kid to Milton Hershey School, and that's where the kid lives. So if that's the system we're talking about going to, I think that's a very good system for inner city kids to have a second chance, and well, not a second, to have a chance. But all we keep hearing about from the right and the moneyed interest, because remember, there's going to be a lot of money in education. There's going to be a lot of money in private education. And not for the teachers, no, no, for the investors. Because the investor class in this country has figured out that we can make a little bit of profit. We can make a buck off of education. We can start making money off this. Because there's money to be had. And what we've got to do then, according to our friends on the extreme right, destroy those teachers' unions. Make those teachers desperate. Now, I've got a friend who's a retired teamster, or a retired teacher. And she said, you know, the parents used to love us. Back when little Johnny or Sally would bring us an apple into school, and that was our lunch. We couldn't afford to buy our own apple. We had to depend on little Johnny or Sally to bring us one. But as soon as we started saying, you know what, we'd like to buy our own apples, that's when the community changed. Well, that's my tax dollars. That's my money. No, that's the future of this nation. That's an investment in the people who are going to take care of you when you're old. And remember this. If you treat them poorly today, think of what's going to happen to you when you're older. And you have a bunch of people who don't know how to put an IV in your arm, and a bunch of people who can't diagnose you with an illness, or who can't even wipe your behind when you can't do it yourself. And I hear this ridiculous nonsense. Oh, well, we need merit pay for teachers because we live in this grand meritocracy. And I've yet to see anybody show me where that meritocracy exists, because it surely doesn't exist in the boardrooms and in the CEO suites. Doesn't exist there. So what we want is we want merit pay for teachers. So basically what merit pay is a way to quickly destroy the inner city schools and quickly get rid of all those kids. Because no teacher in their right mind is going to risk going into an inner city where their pay is based on whether these kids get ahead. When 50% of them are dropping out, 50% of them are failing, and half of the ones that are moving on are struggling at that because they don't have the framework from home. If we want to solve those problems, we've got to invest in that. And that's breaking the cycle of poverty. That's getting the families involved. It's just not the magic bullet of, hey, there's a teacher here. And what's frustrating me is we seem to be turning teaching into a factory job. Now teachers are assembly line workers who children come in front of them and teachers pour in knowledge into these empty vessels called children. That's not how it works, folks. Kids need to learn by doing. They need to experience. It's pretty simple stuff to me. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Chris on line one. How are we doing today, Chris?
Hey, Rick. How are you doing? I couldn't help but listen to what you were just talking about, teachers and teacher pay and the schooling system, which seems to be, for some reason, I guess, a big topic now, I guess, for this next month or so that they talk about it. But I wanted to ask you, did you know that 60% of our PhDs for, you know, science degrees, science doctorates, are actually given to foreign students that use our taxpaying dollars to basically come here, get an education, get their doctorate, and then go back to their home country? Just because if you even look at the euro or the pound or whatever, it's better for them just to go back home when they're done.
Yeah, I did know that. And I thought there were other reasons as well. But the fact that Europe has a much better currency, that's part of it. The other part of it is a lot of countries have where the top 5 or 6 or 10 students in a class can go anywhere to college that they want to go, and the state will pay for it. So a lot of them decide to come here then.
Right.
That's something that we don't want to talk about here in this country. We don't want to actually talk about rewarding kids who, you know, who may not be able to go on and get a master's or a PhD because of financial constraints. I've got a buddy. He's got $200,000 worth of student loans. He's got a PhD, and the best job he can find is making $48,000 a year.
That's unbelievable. I was actually calling because we wanted to show you our website and have you see what you thought about it, but it's called theprimeparty.org, and wanted to just explain it to people. Basically, it seems to be confusing to us is that the Tea Party is doing a great job with their websites and their social networking, and the Democratic side really doesn't seem to have anything like that at their disposal. So that's what we developed and created. And we'd like to see more people use it. We've even been contacting campaigns because for all intents and purposes, we can set up a user page that is analogous to a Facebook page but a lot more capabilities. And we'd like to see campaigns or candidates or even if you have your page, we'd like to set up a page for you guys. But it's definitely something that can connect users in a much more meaningful way in relation to politics and who their favorite candidate is and who they want to stand behind. So we wanted to, you know, just put that out there and also see what you thought about the fact that I think it was on Rachel Maddow last week. There was a person on there speaking about how the Democrats basically weren't doing social networking very effectively at all. And, you know, what you thought about that.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I think the entire center to left has done a poor job of communicating with their constituents. I think the Democrats have done a horrible job of communicating what they've accomplished. And I think if people really knew what this Congress was able to accomplish in the face of a recalcitrant Republican Party, I think they'd be pretty impressed. While I'm not thrilled with what came out of the health care bill, I did watch the process and I did see who put up the roadblocks. And I think if America could see that, there would be no question that there wouldn't be a Republican left in Congress and a bunch of bent-knee Democrats, to be honest, as well. But I think if people saw it, and I'm looking at your site here, primeparty.org, interesting site. I think it'd be a good, not a bad place to come and take a look. I see you have got a lot of different categories of information, and that's what we need. You need something that's going to bring people together.
Right, and I think what candidates are doing today, what you see, especially a lot of Democratic candidates, and I mean, of course, Republicans are too, is they use Facebook and they think that that's the end. And for Democrats, that is the end, Facebook and Twitter.
Right.
And when you go to, you know, any other, you know, let's say that it's, you know, Joe Smith for Congress.com, there's a lot of information that's thrown at you, but there's no interaction for the user. And that's what the Tea Party does so well, is that they can basically throw up whatever propaganda they want and disseminate it as fast as it possibly can go through the internet. And, you know, the Democratic side, there's really just nothing like that. So I hope that I know there's the coffee party and
the beer party.
Right.
Can't forget the beer people.
Oh, the beer party.
Yep. Can't forget them.
What's their website?
I don't know, but there's one that's sent me stuff off, and it's the beer party.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, here's the thing, and this is the part that I think is important to understand. And, yes, I think the Tea Party people have done a very good job of doing what the labor movement used to do, organize. But I also think that they're extremely well-funded, and we don't see that funding up front. You look at the Tea Party Express, when they can run around with 3-4 buses that just the paint job alone is $50,000 to $100,000, you know there's a lot of money there. And that's, for me, I think that the important part that people need to understand, that this isn't just some spontaneous organization that erupted. This was a well-controlled grow and a well-controlled media campaign. That's my opinion on it.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, in our site and, you know, any of the other sites, there, you know, definitely we don't have that type of funding, but the great thing about the internet, especially, you know, anyone that has an internet connection is that you can go on there and it's free. It's just basically setting up something that's sort of organized in enough of a manner that people can connect and say, okay, I agree with that. And you know what? Here's what we have to say. And so, because a lot of the information that comes out from the Tea Party as well is you'll see them sometimes on candidate pages or websites, and they'll say, you know, for example, I read something where it said, you know, Charlie Crist wasn't for the health care bill. He said that it was stealing money from Medicare. And, you know, that's not what Charlie Crist said, but that's what these people get to do with their misinformation.
They get to spin the message.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
I appreciate the call, Christian. Okay. Great information. Again, the website, primeparty.org. I suggest you check it out. We're going to take a quick break. Thanks again. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back.
We want the world.
Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says the challenge to make America's public education system work for all kids can only be met if the whole nation commits to it. At the One Nation March in Washington, D.C., Weingarten said that public school teachers and their unions are committed to achieving the highest quality public education for all.
Every child has a right to a fair and hopeful start in life. Brothers and sisters, we have a choice. We can follow our aspirations, or we can give in to our fears. We here today aspire to our ideals. We here today must invest, not divest, in our kids.
Weingarten urged the public to unite with teachers in a push to improve public education.
We must do it, and I ask you to join America's public school teachers in our quest to make a difference in every child's life. Let's stand together, one nation together.
Legislation approved by the Senate last week will make it easier for federal employees to telework. Jesse Russell explains.
The telework legislation passed by the Senate last week asks agencies to develop policies that would provide employees with opportunities to work remotely, unless they are in a position which makes it a necessity for them to be on site. Under the legislation, each agency will be required to create a telework managing officer position, and that person would be charged with overseeing the telework program. A report from the Office of Personnel Management says that less than 10% of federal workers worked remotely in 2008. Part of the justification for encouraging remote working is that it would help the government continue to function during typically crippling events, such as the snowstorm that brought Washington, D.C. to a standstill in 2009. The legislation will now go back to the House.
The Kohler Company in Wisconsin may become the most recent company to install a two-tiered wage system. Kohler is in contract negotiations with the United Auto Workers and is asking that new employees and workers recalled from layoffs be paid at a rate nearly 35% less than current workers and also not receive health care benefits. The company has also asked union members to accept a 5-year wage freeze. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working hard for a quality public school for every student.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
I got 800 miles of open border right outside my door. There's men in little pickup trucks who declared their own dang war. Now the government wants to build a barrier like old Berlin, 8 feet tall. But if Uncle Sam sends the illegals home, who's gonna build the wall? Who's gonna build your wall?
And Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. In the last segment, we're talking about teachers and the state of education. And look, when the messaging that's out there is that the teachers that are out, that are teaching now, that somehow they're bad teachers. I hear this frame a lot. We need to get rid of the bad teachers. I got to be honest with you. I've never had a bad teacher. I've had some really exceptional teachers. I've had two, in fact, that I would say changed my life. And I'm lucky to have had those two. But I don't think I've ever had a bad teacher. You know, I've had ones that, you know, they do their job. It's those exceptional ones that make us understand exactly what we want out of education. We want kids who are engaged, and we want kids who are learning. And to me, this divide and conquer strategy that the wealth interests of this country are pursuing is dangerous for us. Splitting the money up between, you know, cyber charter and charter schools and, you know, and Christian schools and this school and that school, and all it does is it dwindles down the resources. Instead of saying we're going to give every child the best possible public education, the best possible education with the best resources and the best teachers that we can get our hands on, what we're doing is we seem to be slicing and dicing, picking winners and losers by who's going to be able to afford education. And believe me, the idea here is to destroy education. The idea here is to lure the quote-unquote good teachers to these charter schools, which isn't happening. These charter schools are not setting the world on fire. They're equal to the public schools. But the mean, what we're being told, is that, well, that's the future. And what I'm telling you is, look, there's an attack on teachers in this country. And the reality is most people who I've talked to wouldn't want the job, where they can post your salary online so that any Tom, Dick, or Harry can go search and see how much such and such a teacher makes a year. Would you want your salary posted online? I know I don't want mine. How about your address? How about your home address? You want that to be part of a right-to-know request? That, you know, maybe a crazy think tank and then put that up online? So maybe the kid that you failed, his parents may come visit you sometime. You want that? You want your reviews posted online like this teacher in California? The Los Angeles Times has this rating system that they put up on their website. And while, again, I think you have to have a review of teachers and you have to have a way to see who's doing what, I don't know that on a newspaper website is the place to be putting those ratings. And you look as this guy, Rigoberto Ruluez. He's a teacher in an impoverished, gang-ridden area of South Los Angeles. He's one of these guys who reaches out to the toughest kids in the class, the hardest to reach, tutored them on nights and weekends, visited them at home, and tried to encourage them. This fifth grade teacher, he was so passionate about his mission, they write, that he had nearly perfect attendance for 14 years. 14 years. Well, he killed himself, because the review that he was given was posted online. And, you know, while I can't imagine that a review would send me off the edge, I would think somebody as passionate as the story tells that this guy was could be something that would lead someone to do that. So I guess the question is, how much privacy should we have? How much privacy should teachers have? How about state workers? You know, we keep talking about, well, they work for us. But do we have the right to know how much they make? Do we have the right to know where they live? Do we have the right to know what the conditions, their work conditions are? Do we have a right to know that? Do we have a right to privacy in this country? I mean, we have a right to a privacy of our beliefs, First Amendment. We have the right to privacy in our home. They can't quarter soldiers in our home, thanks to the Third Amendment. We have the right to privacy of my person, my possessions against unreasonable search and seizures, Fourth Amendment. The right not to rat ourselves out, although most people do, in the Fifth Amendment. So how much privacy should we have? If you listen to the guy who's our quote of the day, Eric Schmidt, CEO of Google, he recently described his company's policy as getting right up to the creepy line and not crossing it. He said, quote, with your permission, you give us more information about you, about your friends, and we can improve the quality of our searches. We don't need you to type it all. We know where you are. We know where you've been. And we can more or less know what you're thinking about. Is that the kind of country we want to live in? And you know, this guy Schmidt, he's got a history of grabbing headlines. He's got a history of quotes that, you know, make people step up and take notice. Remember, he said, if you have something you don't want anyone to know about, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. Probably not bad advice. But giving them this portal into our lives, should they be able to hold on to all that information? Recently, he suggested that young people might sometime in the future change their names so they could escape their Google past. Is that the kind of country you want to live in? Last month, he muttered cryptically about having other ways to get access to Facebook's data. They've got other ways. So where do you think Schmidt sees the creepy line? Where do you think someone like Schmidt sees the creepy line? The possibility of maybe Google implanting a chip under your skin so they can track you? And, of course, provide you with web access. And when you walk down past the supermarket, you can have products leap out of the shelves at you because they know you usually buy that. And when you walk down the mall, you can have ads specifically for you, tailored for your consumer needs. Is that the kind of world we want to live in? I remember when my daughter was born. She's not out of the womb more than 4 or 5 hours. And I had a young woman come up to me and ask me if I was interested in a V-chip. Could chip my daughter. Would you be interested in this chip that we're going to... All it is a little glass capsule, she said, put under the skin. It'll help you find her if she's ever abducted. And I said, well, why would I want to do that? Because you can find her, even if she's not abducted. Is that what we're going to do to people? There are some folks who want to talk about the immigration reform by having guest workers that we can chip. We can put guest workers in the fields, and we can put little glass things in their arms. Well, what's to stop them from taking it out? I mean, this technology, folks, is scary stuff. Some of this stuff is scary. So, you know, you got people saying, go ahead, we're gonna chip these workers. Why don't we take a break right here? I want to talk about immigration when we come back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. Stick around.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
No pain, no gain, say the fitness folks. But ouch, this old exercise cliche has been badly twisted by many of America's top CEOs who are getting gains from our pains. A new survey finds that corporate chieftains who inflict economic pain on the company's workers receive more financial gain for themselves. The Institute for Policy Studies examined the layoff-payoff records of America's 500 largest corporations during the past couple of years. IPS researchers report that the 50 CEOs who fired the most rank-and-file employees averaged 42% higher pay than their peers, averaging an extra $3.5 million each. One of the champions in this contest of convoluted corporate compensation was Mark Hurd. As chief executive of computer giant Hewlett-Packard, Hurd dumped 6,400 workers in 2009, a year in which he pocketed a paycheck of $24 million. Earlier this year, Hurd was forced to resign from HP after an internal investigation found that he falsified some expense reports. No need to weep for Mark, though. He was comfortably compensated for this bad turn of fortune, receiving a severance package reportedly worth $40 million. Being bad, you see, can be awfully good for a CEO's bottom line. For example, IPS documented one category of badness to goodness that is especially infuriating. 5 of the 50 leading pink slip issuers last year were also bailout barons. Among them was Kenneth Chenault, honcho of American Express, which got $3.4 billion from us taxpayers to save it from financial ruin. In gratitude, Chenault subsequently offed 4,000 employees, then helped himself to a paycheck of nearly $17 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, to see the full IPS report, go to ips-dc.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are
Some
sold.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You know, if you hear the right wing going crazy this past week, it was because a couple of mayors, and this is an interesting story, a couple of mayors had this meeting down in San Diego, and there were four of them from Mexican cities, and these four mayors were saying, look, you know, you're deporting all of these illegal immigrants from your country who are criminals. And if you look at the reports, we're doing that. The fact that since Obama took office, deportations of convicted criminals have skyrocketed 55%. Now, you know, we're not going after the non-criminal, undocumented workers. We're going after the people who've committed crimes, like the right wing said we should be doing. And I agree. You know, you screw up, you got to go. But these four mayors are going, hey, you're dumping all these people in our community. All of these criminals you're dumping right in our community. Look at the fact that, you know, the one city's had 11, and there are 11 mayors have been killed because we're dumping all of these criminal elements in that area. Now, this is something that has to happen between the State Department of the U.S. and Mexico. Not a couple of mayors. But if you were to listen to the right wing going ballistic about this, you would think it was the Mexican government's official position that they're angry that we're returning their citizens. And it's not that at all. But if you were to listen, that's what they're telling you. Well, Mexico doesn't want them back either. Yeah, these four mayors. And if you were the mayor of one of these four cities, you wouldn't want them in your community either. Because you've got to provide protection for your people. You've got to figure out how to get housing for them and make sure that they've got jobs and there's a safety net under their feet. If you're any type of a decent leader, you're going to do those things and you're going to try to protect your citizens. So when our ICE people go and drop these violent criminals in their right at their doorstep, they're complaining about it. And they said, look, you know, come on, give us a little help here. And this is somewhere where the U.S. government and the Mexican government have to figure out what they're going to do with these folks. Because you can't just dump them at the border and go, here, they're your problem. Because then you make that whole border unstable. And I know we love to, well, it's your problem now, you deal with it. No. That border region is our problem. If you've got an unstable border region, if you've got an entire region of that country that's in civil war, if you will, or under the auspices of a cartel, that's not good for your side of the border either. So what's got to happen is you've got to come down and you've got to figure out how you're going to deal with these situations. And that's where communication is good. And that's where I think conferences like this one were not bad. But boy, if you heard the right, how dare they? How dare they demand that we don't return their citizens? That's not what they said. They said, just don't dump them on our doorstep. Don't put them all right there. And, you know, the one mayor was saying, look, you know, we got 80,000 of them in one shot. Our town's only about 35,000 people. Kind of makes you wonder. I don't know if you saw this in West Virginia. West Virginia is turned into one of my favorite states now because the politics there are fairly interesting to me. You've got the Democratic governor who's running for Byrd's seat for the Senate, running against this silver spooned guy, John Reyes, who, you know, of course, he made his money the old fashioned way. He inherited it and would like all of us to inherit money just so he doesn't have to pay taxes. If we could do with, like I've said yesterday, I said what we should be doing with taxes is just changing the name. Thanks to Tom Corbett, the guy who's running for governor here, we can no longer call it taxes. They're contributions. You're making contributions to help the state. Anyway, this is why I think a lot of people have problems with Democrats. From the Charleston newspaper there, they write Governor Joe Manchin has scheduled a press conference Wednesday morning where he's expected to announce that the state is filing suit against the federal government over the Obama administration's crackdown of mountaintop removal coal mining. Late Tuesday, the governor's office announced a 9 a.m. press conference where Manchin would discuss the coal mine permitting process in West Virginia. The release said various representatives from the coal mining community would join Manchin at the event. Sources said the governor was expected to announce the long-anticipated lawsuit against the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, but administrative officials declined to confirm those details until Manchin makes his pitch. While the coal industry favors mountaintop removal's efficiency and local politicians praise the jobs provided, there is growing scientific consensus that the practice is causing widespread and irreversible damage to the region's forests, water quality, and community. Look, at the end of this, you've got to think this guy's in a neck-and-neck race. He's going to do whatever he's got to do to kowtow to the industry that is running that state and has been running that state for generations. And one of my concerns is that the state of Pennsylvania will go back to that. The state of Pennsylvania is going to end up, just like West Virginia, in a political sense, that the natural gas industry will be the ones that all the politicians are kowtowing to. And going back to the article last week, the EPA's Independent Science Advisory Board issued a draft report that backed the agency's scientific findings about the impact and needed reforms in regulatory standards. John Reyes, Republican, has alleged that Manchin has not shown enough support for the mining industry and would not stand up to President Obama on coal-related issues. Think about this for a second. You've got two guys who are basically on the same exact side. There's no choice there when it comes to this issue. And as I understand it, in West Virginia, coal is king. Just like my fear that natural gas will be king here. That we're not going to be able to, if we let this get away from us, if we allow this industry to get out of hand, if we allow this industry to buy our politicians, and really to control the message. If we allow that to happen, if the horse is out of the barn, we're going to end up like West Virginia, where you're going to have two candidates who doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that mountaintop removal completely destroys an area. It doesn't matter that it's almost like nuclear warfare. That doesn't matter. And my good friend Bob Kincaid, and I appreciate my horn listeners sticking around. My good friend Bob gave me a book, The Plundering of Appalachia. And I flipped through the pages of this book just marveling at the man-made destruction that West Virginia has gone, Tennessee and Kentucky have undergone. And for what? As I understand, it's not an awful lot of coal that comes out, but it's profitable. It's not a lot of coal. I'm told about 5% of the coal that we use comes from mountaintop removal, but it's extremely profitable. Now, granted, the land is never going to be useful. Not in our lifetime, not in my children's lifetime, not in their children's lifetime. This land is barren wasteland, and we're making these huge sludge pits that we're never going to be able to deal with environmentally. And at the end of it, when the coal is gone and the mines close and the fat cats leave and they filled their pockets to the brim and they've gone on, who ends up holding the bag? Because this is very real. We are on the front part. We're on the front nine here with the natural gas industry. You know, they've already teed off. They're down. They're heading down the fairway, and we're catching up with the bag. The question is do we ever catch up? Are we going to have politicians with the foresight and the courage to stand up and say, you know what? You're going to have to pay a little bit. You're going to have to pay some money, a reasonable severance tax, a reasonable tax for the devastation and the destruction that you are going to cause. And this ridiculous notion, as Tom Corbett says, well, we want to make sure that they have enough insurance. Well, you know, do you think BP would have had enough insurance had they chosen to go the bankruptcy route, as there was some talk of happening? You know, is a small company going to go up there and start drilling? And, oh, we made a mistake. Bankrupt. Oh, the insurance company, oh, we don't have the money for that. We're bankrupt. Who ends up holding the bag? The ultimate insurer, the taxpayer. And that's what we are, folks. We're the ultimate insurer. When all else fails, it falls back onto us. When all else goes to hell, who picks up the mess? We, the working class taxpayers of this country. The investor class, they don't pay their taxes. Come on. Oh, but they pay more than everybody. In large dollars, yeah, because they've got all the money. Yeah, if you got a bunch of people who are broke, what are you going to get out of them? Nothing. You got an investor class, the Forbes 400, $1.37 trillion in wealth in the hands of 400 people. Yeah, of course they're going to pay more in actual dollars. But when you look at the percentage that they're paying, it's not that much. In fact, it's less than most people who work for a living. It's less than most people who actually do the hard work in this country. And I look at this race in West Virginia, and it's like a crystal ball to me. It's the future of our state if we don't get this right. It is the future of what my children are going to have to deal with. Because the industry's not going away, regardless of what happens. Even if we were to put a 50% tax on it and incentivize it with smart incentives, they're not going away. The gas is here. This is where the gas is. It's like West Virginia. It's like saying, you know what? We're gonna leave West Virginia if you don't let us rape your mountains. And we're gonna go to Kansas. Or we're gonna go to, you know, to a plain state. It's not gonna work. The coal's there. The natural gas is here. They're not going anywhere. So stop with the, if we don't let them rape and pillage, they won't bring us jobs. Well, is that what we want? No, even if, I mean, really, we know what they're going to do. We've seen it. The question is, how do we slow it down? How do we make sure that everybody profits? After all, it is our resource. You think of all the wealth that has been taken out of the ground in West Virginia. Stop and think about all the money, all of the billionaires that have been made pulling that coal out of the ground. And yet it's one of the poorest states in the country. It's got natural, an abundance of natural resource. Yet it's one of the poorest states in the country. Why is that? Because it's got dumb laws. It's got bad policy. And why does it have bad policy? Because it's got bought politicians. It's that simple. We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back with your call. Stick around.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influenced President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healey Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, that's what they seem to be doing. That's what corporate America seems to be doing. I'll tell you, hoarding is what they're doing. Our quote of the day comes from Rick Poor, owner of Design Incorporated from Lincoln, Nebraska. He says, quote, "As a fellow businessman once told me, give me more customers and I'll be forced to buy equipment and hire people to meet demand. Give me a tax break without more customers and I'll just go to Aruba." And I don't think truer words have been spoken. And you look at this New York Times article that came out today that says, as many households and small businesses are being turned away by bank loan officers, large corporations are borrowing vast sums of money for next to nothing, simply because they can. Companies like Microsoft are raising billions of dollars by issuing bonds at ultra-low interest rates, but few of them are actually spending the money on new factories, equipment, or jobs. Instead, they're stockpiling the cash until the economy improves. The development presents something of a chicken or egg situation. Corporations keep saving, waiting for the economy to perk up, but the economy is not going to perk up unless corporations start spending. The Federal Reserve has held official interest rates at near zero for almost 2 years, allowing corporations to hoard money. Companies are not investing. They're not hiring workers. Right now, it's reported that corporations are sitting on about $1.6 trillion, this $1.6 trillion mountain of cash. And the New York Times asks, when are they going to start spending the money? When are they going to start hiring? When will corporate America start to feel confident enough to put cash to work, building factories and putting some of the nation's nearly 15 million unemployed back to work? And I'll tell you when, because you know when it's going to happen. When their right-wing hacks take over Congress and further destroy what little regulations left. This way, corporations can have unrestrained power to rape and pillage. The cheap money may have been yet another effect, they say, another unintended policy thing for policymakers eager to cut the 9.6% unemployment rate. Several corporations borrowing billions on the bond market are using the money to put their own fiscal house in order. So they're paying off their own debt. And who are they paying it off on the back of? You and me. We're the ones who are funding all of this stuff. And look, I was against it from the very beginning. Stop with the low interest loans. We don't need any more loans. Business doesn't need a loan. They don't need a tax break. Stop with that. We need demand. We need the federal government to say, you know what, we're going to put solar panels on every single house. We need the states to say, you know what, we need cars that are fuel efficient. We don't need more tax breaks. We don't need more cheap loans. That's what got us into this mess. The availability of cheap credit for corporations to keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing is what got us into this mess. This leveraging of leveraging. That's what got us here. Microsoft said it was using some of the money to buy back its shares. Other companies are locking into long-term borrowing. And some of the new borrowing is financed all these acquisitions and these mergers. So what we've done by making cheap credit available is we've actually consolidated. We've actually made too big to fail, really big and too big to fail. And it's filling. Whose pockets does it fill? The same pockets it always fills. The shareholders, the investor class. Corporations have become so good that some companies are borrowing money that they're not going to have to pay until the next century. Norfolk Southern Railroad. They borrowed $250 million in 100-year bonds at a rate less than 6%. How do I get a 100-year loan? How does an individual get a 100-year loan? You can't. And if you did, boy, you wouldn't get the flat 5.9 rate. Mm-mm. You'd get that mortgage loan where they rape and pillage. Other companies are borrowing to finance acquisitions. Pepsi recently helped pay for the takeover of 2 bottling plants. Hertz borrowed $300 million to buy Dollar Thrifty. Is that the kind of country we want to live in? Where we're handing corporations huge sums of money, massive sums of money. While you look at programs like Undercover Boss, where you've got workers who are working for peanuts, struggling to get by. Which brings me into my email of the day. Again, if you want to email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails, and I occasionally like to pick one up here on the air. Jackson writes me, Rick, the Undercover Boss program's a good show. You raise very good points, though, especially about maternity leave. My girlfriend had a baby last year, and she had to quit her job. It was really tough for a while, but we managed through. Why is there nothing to help us like what you talked about? Well, because we believe in, hey, you're an individual. You can do it yourself. We believe we're a pro-birth nation. We're going to fight against abortion. We're going to fight for the birth of that child. And we're going to fight for that child until it pops out. And then, oh, not mine. Not my problem. Don't raise my taxes. Or you look at a country like countries like Sweden and Norway. All working parents get 16 months paid maternity. 16 months paid maternity to stay home with their child. It's paid for by the a split between the employer and the state. You want to talk about promoting family values? There you go. In Estonia, mothers are paid 18 months of paid maternity leave, starting up to 70 days before their due date, paid 100% of their wages, 70 days prior. So if they've got some complications, you know, they can go to the doctor and make sure that they're taken care of. They don't have to sweat taking a day off from work. Look at Bulgaria. Bulgaria provides mothers with 45 days at 100% paid sick leave prior to their due dates and 2 years of paid leave and an additional 1 year of unpaid leave. And the employer must return that mother to the same position she had when she left. In addition, and this is something that's, wow, Bulgaria, good for you. Pregnant women can't be fired, and neither can single mothers. Because you know what? Sometimes kids get sick, and you got to go to the school, and you got to pick them up. And you know, sometimes they can't go to school because they're sick, like my kids this morning. If it wasn't for the fact that my wife stays home, who knows if I'd have been able to go to work. Lithuania is home to the most generous maternity leave benefits. Mothers are provided with 8 weeks of 100% paid leave before the due date, and 100% of their pay for the first year, 85% of their pay the second year, and an unpaid third year if they so choose. And here's the family value thing popping its ugly, angry head. Either mother or father can take that leave. Yet here in this country, nothing. Nothing. In Canada, our hat. They give families 50 weeks of paid maternity time that can be divided between the parents. It's paid for by their insurance system. The UK, females are entitled to 52 weeks maternity leave, 39 of those paid. You know what we have in Pennsylvania? Right here, you know what we have? We have nothing. We have zero, nothing. No paid maternity leave whatsoever. And you know what the advice I've heard for women considering to have children? You want to know what the advice they get? Why don't you buy some high-cost, short-term disability policy? A disability policy. Do we really have a skewed view of how childbirth is? Boy, that's family values. Family values. Yeah, we've got a Family Medical Leave Act. Thanks, Bill Clinton. A little short. There's no money in it. If you wanted to take some time off, you've got to be working for that employer for at least 12 months. And you better have had 1,250 hours in that year. The company has to have at least 50 employees, and if there aren't 50 employees, you don't get it. You're entitled to 12 weeks of unpaid leave. 12 weeks. Think about this. 12 weeks. Unpaid. And you get to keep your health insurance. And when you go back, they have to bring you back to work at your old job or something equal to. Now, when you come back to that old job, they can let you work a day or two and say, you know what, we don't need you anymore, because Pennsylvania is, after all, an at-work state, an at-will state, which means you're at my will. If I don't want, you're out the door. You have no recourse other than to collect unemployment. That's family values. And we're supposed to be a Christian nation? And this is how we treat families? This is how we treat mothers? That's beautiful. The hypocrisy. And yet, most people don't know any of this stuff. The rest of the world is far ahead of us when it comes to family values. But we like to pump out our chests and say, we're number one! Yep, we are. Number one to the bottom. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says the challenge to make America's public education system work for all kids can only be met if the whole nation commits to it. At the One Nation March in Washington, D.C., Weingarten said that public school teachers and their unions are committed to achieving the highest quality public education for all.
Every child has a right to a fair and hopeful start in life. Brothers and sisters, we have a choice. We can follow our aspirations, or we can give in to our fears. We here today aspire to our ideals. We here today must invest, not divest, in our kids.
Weingarten urged the public to unite with teachers in a push to improve public education.
We must do it, and I ask you to join America's public school teachers in our quest to make a difference in every child's life. Let's stand together, one nation together.
Legislation approved by the Senate last week will make it easier for federal employees to telework. Jesse Russell explains.
The telework legislation passed by the Senate last week asks agencies to develop policies that would provide employees with opportunities to work remotely, unless they are in a position which makes it a necessity for them to be on site. Under the legislation, each agency will be required to create a telework managing officer position, and that person would be charged with overseeing the telework program. A report from the Office of Personnel Management says that less than 10% of federal workers worked remotely in 2008. Part of the justification for encouraging remote working is that it would help the government continue to function during typically crippling events, such as the snowstorm that brought Washington, D.C. to a standstill in 2009. The legislation will now go back to the House.
The Kohler Company in Wisconsin may become the most recent company to install a two-tiered wage system. Kohler is in contract negotiations with the United Auto Workers and is asking that new employees and workers recalled from layoffs be paid at a rate nearly 35% less than current workers and also not receive health care benefits. The company has also asked union members to accept a five-year wage freeze. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working hard for a quality public school for every student.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Yeah, that's good stripper music. Yeah, I think there's a senior U.S. district judge down in Atlanta could get a little of that. Jack T. Camp, Jr., former chief judge at the U.S. District Court in Atlanta. He was arrested for buying coke, marijuana, and prescription painkillers from a stripper. And remember this, this guy was a Reagan appointee. So I guess my advice was, dude, just say no. Remember? Just say no. Say no to the hooker with the coke. It's time to think about how many people have gotten in trouble because of a hooker and coke. Personally, I never have. I prefer Pepsi. But, you know, that's just my preference. Camp allegedly had been involved with this exotic dancer after purchasing a private dance, according to Gawker.com. It must have been a pretty good dance, I would think, because he kept coming back night after night, dance after dance. And then, he got a little bit. Got a little on the side there. Conservative values. You just gotta love that. You gotta love the good conservative value there. Gawker writes, the relationship between the stripper and the 67-year-old judge apparently revolved around drugs and sex, mostly cocaine, marijuana, and the, of course, the prescription painkiller, Roxycodone. Sometimes Camp would give the stripper money for the drugs, and sometimes the two lovebirds would go off to buy drugs together. What a good family value kind of thing to do, don't you think? Unfortunately for Camp, and you gotta love this, the exotic dancer was recording many of their conversations and feeding them to the FBI. Last Friday, in a recorded conversation, Camp told the stripper he would try to help her get a job because she was having a little problem. You know, she's got, you know, like many stripper hooker types, you know, they got a little scrape with the law. So the judge was going to call this potential employer and, you know, smooth things over. And during the conversation, the two of them discussed having a second woman join them. Again, righto with the family values right there. Going to have the threesome there that night. But Camp thought it was a little too risky to do drugs with someone he didn't trust because he was in a precarious situation. Think about that for a second. The hooker who's feeding information to the FBI, he trusts. But the other one, no, not so much. Later Friday, the stripper asked Camp if he could follow her to a drug dealer to protect her. Now, this is where it gets crazy for me. What exactly is a judge driving around town with a hooker for and saying, oh, yeah, I'll go with you to a drug deal? She says because she said she wanted him to come along because, you know, she'd only dealt with this drug dealer a couple of times. And according to the affidavit, Camp's response was, I'll watch your back anytime, not only with my little pistol. I've got my big pistol, so we'll take care of any problems that come up. I wonder which was the little and which was the big pistol. I don't think it matters. Anyway, he was arrested that night after buying drugs in the parking lot of the Velvet Room. I think it'd have been better if it was the Champagne Room, but Velvet Room is good. You can't have everything. The judge, Gawker reports, has a history and a reputation of being a harsh sentencer. So, you know, again, you see this theme playing out again and again with the conservatives. With these people who are iron-fisted and want to, you know, we're gonna control things and we're law and order type people. These are the people who are out doing this stuff. I mean, my favorite all-time story, and I will tell it until I die. Bob Allen in Florida is absolutely the picture of ridiculous, hate-mongering, fear-filled Republican that you will ever meet, self-loathing human being that you'll ever meet. As a state legislator in the state of Florida, every year while he was in office, he proposed a bill that said if men engage in sex in a bathroom, it is a felony with a mandatory year in jail. It is a felony. So what does he do? It's a rainy day. Rainy day in Florida. And he's walking through the park, just whistling, enjoying the birds, watching the water run down the creek. And the rain's coming. I need to go into the bathroom to hide, of course, from get some shelter. And there was a very large black man. It seems like these stories always have a very large black man in it. But this one actually did. So Bob Allen, who, you know, timid guy, you know, afraid of the rain, might melt. He walks into a bathroom. There's a large black man there. He's scared. Oh, large black man. I must pay him to have sex with me. Think about that for a second. Turns out the large black man was an undercover cop. Put there because Bob Allen kept bringing this up. So the police department said, well, we better do something about it. They sent a cop. I mean, think about that for a second. I think that is hysterical. You look at Pastor Ted, another one. I think I know what you did last night. Send me $1,000 and I won't tell your wife. And what's he doing? He's sniffing crack off the backside of a male hooker while pushing legislation trying to make homosexuality illegal. What kind of a self-loathing human being do you have to be? I don't mind if he sniffs crack off the backside of a male hooker. None of my business. I'm not doing it. He's not doing it in my house. As long as they're consenting adults and doesn't infringe on my rights, you do what you got to do. I'm kind of libertarian in that way. In fact, I'm extremely libertarian in that way. You do what you got to do. As long as it's consenting adults in the confines of your home is your castle. You do what you got to do in there, buddy. Or Jane, you know, whichever. I'm not going to discriminate. There's a new video game on the market. No sex in this one, sorry. So the Republicans probably, you know, our closeted Republicans probably won't be interested. But from the USA Today, President Obama's approval rating may be taking some hits, but his court cred is taking a leap. He's among the unlockable characters in a new NBA Jam video game out today. So you rush right out to the store and get your video game that will be available on the Wii. I love that. Wii. Being a hoops fanatic, as the president is, it's not a prerequisite for NBA Jam treatment. They did this with President Clinton back in 94, the original version. But developers for the new Wii game took special care this time. Trey Smith, the creative director, said, since the president is a baller, we kind of blew it out of even further, he said. When you dunk with him, he has some special animations and some special dunks. So if you're into that, that's your kind of game. You can play Democrats versus Republicans. On the Democratic side, you got Vice President Biden, former President Clinton, Bill Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And on the Republican side, of course, you got John McCain and his tag along, Sarah Palin. And of course, former President George Bush and Dick Cheney. I would love to see if the perfect part of this code would be that Cheney doesn't really play. He just shoots everybody in the face. That would be a good code to have. You know, so instead of having the guy who does the voice, and the guy's name's Tim Kurtzrow, doing his boom shakalaka or he's on fire, he could do something like, he's shot in the face. I guess he's going to have to apologize. I think I'm going to run right out and get this game. But anyway, both political teams have their own uniforms, logos, and home court. So they threw some work into this. So that'll be interesting for the 35-plus crowd who, you know, unmarried, still living in their mother's basement. The video crowd. Very good. Here comes the sun. It appears the White House is going to be putting solar panels on the White House, and I'm thrilled about this. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago on our weekend show, that the president had been in the process of using some solar panels. I think he should have done that right from the beginning. It would have sent a nice message right from the beginning. So they're putting these up. Should be installed by the spring of 11. It will heat all the hot water and will supply some electricity. The plans will be formally announced. They were today. And so good. We're going to see some of that. Here's what I think is important and why I think this is such an important story. This is telling the people of this country, look, I believe in investing in this. And I wish the president would have done it one of the first things he would have done in office. Because what he does, people do pay attention to. And if the president is investing in solar technology, and it better be American-made. It better be a solar panel that came from somewhere in this country. It better not be Chinese-made, or I'm going to be flipping mad. But it sends the message that this is the right direction. And he should have followed it up with, and they did, with some policies that got some money out, but I don't think enough. What they should have done is they should have said, look, no tax breaks, no, none of this nonsense. We're not giving out any more money. No more money. No breaks, no incentives. We're going to buy stuff from you. If you make solar panels, we're going to buy solar panels. We're going to buy a lot of them. And we're going to price them at this price. Can you build them at this price? We're not paying a dime more. And you know what? We want more made so that other people can buy at the same price that we buy. So that if Rick Smith wants to put solar panels on his house to heat his hot water, he can do that. If we wanted to invest in solar technology so that 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the road, those panels are still producing hot water, we could do that. And there should have been a loan program for me, for Rick Smith, to go, you know what? I'd like to do it, but I don't have the money. So give me a 20-year, give me a 100-year loan to pay off that $30,000 investment, the loan that you've given corporate America. That's what he should have been doing. And that's what I would, that's what I said I would have done right from the very beginning. But then again, I don't have a red phone going into the White House. But he should. He should put that red phone in. We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
You know, I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
No pain, no gain, say the fitness folks. But ouch, this old exercise cliche has been badly twisted by many of America's top CEOs who are getting gains from our pains. A new survey finds that corporate chieftains who inflict economic pain on the company's workers receive more financial gain for themselves. The Institute for Policy Studies examined the layoff-payoff records of America's 500 largest corporations during the past couple of years. IPS researchers report that the 50 CEOs who fired the most rank-and-file employees averaged 42% higher pay than their peers, averaging an extra $3.5 million each. One of the champions in this contest of convoluted corporate compensation was Mark Hurd. As chief executive of computer giant Hewlett-Packard, Hurd dumped 6,400 workers in 2009, a year in which he pocketed a paycheck of $24 million. Earlier this year, Hurd was forced to resign from HP after an internal investigation found that he falsified some expense reports. No need to weep for Mark, though. He was comfortably compensated for this bad turn of fortune, receiving a severance package reportedly worth $40 million. Being bad, you see, can be awfully good for a CEO's bottom line. For example, IPS documented one category of badness to goodness that is especially infuriating. Five of the 50 leading pink slip issuers last year were also bailout barons. Among them was Kenneth Chenault, honcho of American Express, which got $3.4 billion from us taxpayers to save it from financial ruin. In gratitude, Chenault subsequently offed 4,000 employees, then helped himself to a paycheck of nearly $17 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, to see the full IPS report, go to ips-dc.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Soon as you're born, they'll make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
A working class hero is something to be.
The taxation system has tilted toward the rich and away from the middle class.
A working class hero is something to be. They hit you at home and they hit you at school.
Yeah, well, I can identify with the hit you at school part. Growing up in a Catholic school with those evil, repressed nuns with that stick. That's all I remember. But here's the part. Buffett's right. And what you heard Buffett say, it's class warfare. My class is winning. But they shouldn't be. And CNN Money reported today that Warren Buffett said it's time to raise taxes on the very rich and perhaps cutting them for the rest of the population. Buffett, the billionaire investor who runs Berkshire Hathaway, said Tuesday at Fortune's Most Powerful Women Summit in Washington that the nation's tax code, quote, has gotten distorted to a huge extent by levying higher taxes on secretaries and janitors than on CEOs and private equity whiners. His word, not mine. He called, as he has in the past, for policymakers to redress that inequity by raising taxes on the rich, Buffett said that taxes would have to rise in general in the coming years if we want to dig our way out of the giant budget deficit. He said, quote, we are not taking enough money in at the federal level. Tax collection, he says, has to go up to the range of 18 to 20%. Currently, it is below 15%. But Buffett also added a new twist, saying that we should be cutting taxes on the poor people, raising them on the top, cutting them at the bottom. And look, the reality here, and I've talked about this ad nauseum, is I agree with the Tea Party. I agree with those people who know what T stands for. I am taxed enough already. I think most of us are. I'm feed enough already. I don't want to pay anymore. We don't have it. As a class of people, as a working class in this country, we are tapped out. I absolutely agree with the T moniker. We are taxed enough already. Absolutely agree with it. But I don't agree with, oh, we just need to cut taxes. Cut taxes, that's the answer. Cut taxes, that's the answer. It's not the answer. Cutting taxes on the very wealthy is what got us into this mess. Handing over trillions of dollars in wealth, redistributing trillions of dollars of wealth from me to Warren Buffett is not the answer. Sorry, it's just not the answer. And I had a guy on my weekend program call, and he proclaimed that, well, you know, we don't want to tax the rich because they give us jobs. They give us jobs. I got to be honest. I've never had anyone give me a job. No one's ever given it to me. I've sat down at a desk with somebody and they've said, well, what can you do for me? I've had many of interview where people go, can I make money off this guy? Can the work that he can do for me make me more than I'm going to have to pay him? I've had a bunch of those. I've never had anyone put their arm around me and go, Rick, you know, I like you a lot. You're a good guy. Come on in and, you know, I'm going to give you a job. You don't have to do anything for it. Just come on in, sit down, collect a paycheck. Never had that. I've had people, like I said, who've said, Rick, what can you do for me? So this idea that the rich give us jobs is nonsense. The rich use our labor. They use our bodies. They use our minds to profit for themselves. And the reality is that we have let our labor become worth less and less and less because we've separated ourselves from each other. We're now individuals. I can make my own deal. But which usually ends up being I'll make my own crappy deal. And generally they do. But nobody ever gave you the job. They said, I'm going to make some money off of you. And we need to understand that. And just like Tom Corbett here, the guy who's running for governor. Oh, gee, you know, if we tax the Marcellus Shale, they won't give us jobs. Nonsense. The natural gas is here. Where are they going to get it from? China? They're going to go to China and drill through the core of the earth to get the natural gas that's here in Pennsylvania? I don't think so. But if you listen to the Republicans, man, if we tax them, they just won't come. They won't come. They'll go somewhere else. No, they won't. Let's go to the phone lines. We got Christian on line one. How are we doing today, Christian?
Hey, Rick. I wanted to say you're spot on, but I wanted to take it a step further. I was a financial advisor years ago, and the dirty little secret that I found, because I was young back then and I didn't realize it, but... with the wealthy, especially the wealthy, the more wealthy you get, the better tax code, the better the tax code works for you.
Yep.
Is that the tax bracket is completely a falsity. It's not real. And I don't think people understand that at all, is that you're only taxed on, you know, at the end of the day, what your taxable income is.
Exactly.
And so what I learned as a financial advisor, I had a guy that came in and he, you know, made $250,000, and he himself was a CPA, and he was bragging about how he only paid $250 in taxes. And the way that he does that, and any wealthy person that can afford a really good CPA at the end of the year, is you you only get taxed on your taxable income. So all those deductions and all those, you know, after everything is written off, you're only taxed on a certain portion. You could be taxed on 90% of $10,000 if you're making $1 million a year. It doesn't really matter. So, you know, I think the middle class, and especially, you know, people that, you know, just don't afford or use the 1040 EZ or just the regular tax form, don't realize that not only are these wealthy people complaining about the taxes, they're not really paying the tax bracket they're in anyway.
No, they're not.
It's ridiculous.
And what we're paying for, and look, you know, we're especially when you're talking about small businesses, I know several small business owners and larger size business owners who they don't own their cars. They lease them through their business and they use them for personal use, but they're business cars. They get loge boxes to the stadiums that the company pays for. They don't own anything. It's all through the corporate form. So they're not really paying tax on that either. I mean, it's amazing that the loopholes that they've been able to get put into the law for them so that they can avoid taxes. And that's what it's really about.
Exactly. I challenge you next time somebody says their taxes are too high, ask them what their ETR is. It's called your effective tax rate. And I can guarantee you people's ETRs are lower. You'll find out more times than not people's ETRs are lower than what the lowest tax bracket is. Which is unbelievable.
Well, when you got 47% of the people who pay zero taxes, most of the people I meet don't really pay any, although they think, boy, it came out of my check. But they don't realize at the end of the year they got some of it back. It's right. Amazing. Let me ask you this while I got you on the line. Has anyone ever given you a job? Said, you know, Christian, I think you're a decent guy. I'm going to give you this job. Have they ever done that?
No, absolutely. They need me, just like I need them. It's a mutual win-win relationship. I'm an asset to the company. And they pay my salary.
And if you were as dumb as a stick and didn't know how to get around those loopholes and do the fancy math that you do there, do you think they'd hire you?
No, not at all.
See, I'm just not getting the point that someone says, "Oh, they give us jobs." I appreciate the call, Christian. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robert.
I go back to that. Nobody's ever given me a job, and like he's pointed out, they don't really pay that tax rate anyway. It's all these loopholes. And you go back to the 50s, during the good socialist years of Dwight Eisenhower, when the top marginal rate was 92%. Now, he didn't pay 92% on every penny. It was a progressive tax where the more you made, the more you paid as you went up. And that dollar over the next level is what you were taxed at. The bottom rate was 20%. The bottom rate was 20%. But middle-class people had tax breaks, too. Middle-class people could, on credit cards, for instance, deduct the interest. On any bank loans, you could deduct the interest. Isn't that a nice thing? You know, just like your mortgage now. You had a car loan, you paid interest on the car loan, you were able to deduct that. Well, you could thank Ronald Reagan for taking that away, because that was part of the whole tax reform bill of 86, where they actually raised the bottom level on poor people, raised their taxes, and lowered the top level. And for you folks lucky enough to be in the middle, they did away with all those tax breaks, all those loopholes for the middle class. Now, they kept the ones for the folks at the top, you know, the people who give them campaign contributions. But you folks in the middle, you keep getting squeezed. And I agree with you. I'm taxed enough already. I absolutely agree with that model. So the question is, where do we go? Do we continue down the path of no new taxes, no new taxes, like Corbett and his no new tax pledge that he really only meant on corporations and not workers? Because if you look at the debate he had with Honorado last week, he said flat out when asked, how are you going to close the $3 billion hole that the federal government money is going to leave? And he said, well, I'm going to raise payroll taxes, I'm going to cut their checks. But we're not going to raise the payroll tax on the employers. So you, the worker, you get screwed again. And then when we said, hey, you broke your pledge. No, 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 no. Unemployment compensation, that's not a tax. That's a contribution. So when they took it out of my check without choice, I didn't have a choice there. I was actually contributing. So as I've been saying all week, I think we should change the name. No more tax. No more taxes. All contributions. So we just ask the very wealthy to contribute more. That's my point. Also, Rand Paul, our good friend down in Kentucky, I'm sure you seniors are going to love this. He wants to have a $2,000 deductible on Medicare. But they don't want to destroy Medicare. They want to make it stronger by making you pay more for it. I mean, think about this stuff for a minute, folks. They are telling you what they're going to do after November 2nd. You know, they don't just say this stuff because they like to get the attention. They mean it. They believe it. When Miller out in Alaska says, you know what? Minimum wage should be unconstitutional. Don't think anybody should have the minimum wage. He means it. When he says unemployment compensation is unconstitutional, he means it. And when this guy says, you know what, $2,000 deductible, he means it. When Pat Toomey says, I want personal accounts, that's privatization. He means it. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with Alex Kaplan from Common Cause. Stick around.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'm an announcer winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America for the better.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833. And consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Hughley Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
To the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out our website at therickSmithShow.com. And yes, yes, money is the topic here. You know, the Pennsylvania House just passed its bill to assess what I'm calling a reasonable, even a small severance tax on the natural gas extraction that's going to be ramping up here in the years that come. And as big drilling companies descend on Pennsylvania, the question is, how do we protect our land and our environment? And the other question that I have right now is, why can't we seem to get anything done in the Senate? And what about what happened in the House? I've got Alex Kaplan here. He's with Common Cause, their website, commoncause.org. He's written a piece, Big Drilling Deep Pockets, which I think is a must-read for every citizen in the state of Pennsylvania. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at the vote that came down on the House bill. And there's some glaring things that pop out at me, such as the people who voted for the bill didn't get an awful lot of money from the natural gas industry, and the people who did did get a lot of money from the natural gas industry.
That's right. Right after the vote happened, we jumped on it and ran the numbers that we've been compiling since numbers since 2001 of the contributions from natural gas industry, political action committees, and executives. And we found of the 94 who voted no against the tax, took on average $2,900 from the gas industry, whereas the 104 who voted for the tax, which passed in the House, took an average of $824, which $2,900 is 3.5 times as much as that.
You know, what jumps out at me is, you know, the average of $2,900 to buy, you know, for people who didn't vote against it doesn't seem like an awful lot of money to me.
No. It's not an awful lot of money because it's an average. There are a lot of representatives on both sides of the vote who didn't take any money at all. The vote was split basically along party lines, where most Democrats voted for the tax and most Republicans voted against. What you see that's interesting is that the a lot of the powerful people in the House, like Bill DeWeese, who's a Democrat who did vote against it, Jeff Pyle and others, John Purzel, got a good amount of money. Bill DeWeese took $29,000. Reed took $57,000.
Wow.
These are all no votes. When you go down to the yes votes, the person who took the most, who did actually vote yes, a Democrat, Keith Call, at $12,000. And the number of Democrats that flipped over against their party and ended up voting no, 10 of them, they accepted a total of $64,700 from the gas industry together. So an average of $6,400 about. The 12 Republicans who did vote in favor of the bill accepted only a total of $1,500, and that's an average of $125. And only three of those 12 Republicans who did vote for the bill actually received any contributions at all. I think that's the most telling story right there.
Yeah, I agree.
Who's going to flip to the other side.
Yeah, I agree with you. And what it shows me two things. One, that the industry is putting money where their votes are. And two, it doesn't take an awful lot of money to really influence some of these folks.
That's right. And, you know, it costs an exorbitant amount of money to run a congressional campaign. It's not, of course, cheap to run a state campaign, especially some races far more expensive than others. But in certain races, a couple thousand dollars really means a lot in terms of access and influence. Well, also have to remember that this is data through June. So all of these representatives who are, of course, running re-election campaigns in the House we don't have data on them quite yet for these very important months of fundraising from June until now, October, when this month's happening.
You know, what's interesting to me is that you've got all this money flowing in from the side of the natural gas industry to protect itself from having to give back to the community. Yet I don't know that there's an awful lot of money being put into the other side of we the citizens, we the taxpayers, saying, hey, what about us?
No, there's not. I mean, there's always the problem of, especially here in Pennsylvania, where we have no contribution limits whatsoever, where 40 other states do, and at the federal level, of course, you have contribution limits. You know, we've always run the risk, of course, and it actually happens, of wealthy individuals and special interests being able to donate as much as they want. And then there's the other problem, the fact that, you know, if you've got citizens scattered throughout the state who are worried about gas drilling and want to support candidates who they know will, vote for something like the severance tax, or perhaps if that's what they want, vote against drilling, they can't afford to give that much, and they don't act together as an industry. They're not going to be recognized for this person gave 100, this person gave 100, but all together we understand that these people are supporting us for this reason. Whereas when you get money from the natural gas industry, you know, $150,000 check from an executive, $25,000 check from a PAC, they know that these fundraisers know exactly who they're coming from. There's a purpose behind it.
Yeah, you absolutely know who you owe. And with that in mind, Alex Kaplan, you know, I look to the gubernatorial race here in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely.
I've been seeing Tom Corbett running a lot of ads going, well, you know, we don't want to tax them, because if we put a tax on them, they may not come and we may not get these jobs. I say horse pucky, but I think there's an underlying reason as well.
There is. I mean, it's not to say that the natural gas industry hasn't done the smart thing that happens at the national level for all big corporations and given a lot to both candidates. Through June again, just through June, we contracted about 370,000 to Corbett from the natural gas industry and just about 80 for Dan Honorato. We want to keep going with those numbers, and that's such an important race right now for the state and in so many ways. I'm currently working on the most recent cycle, which is June through September, and I have seen quite a lot of money coming in from both sides to both Dan Honorato and Corbett in a way that continues to very much support Corbett more. Once we get done with those numbers, either tomorrow or the next day, those will be published on our project website called MarcellusMoney.org, where you can also find the data sheet about this House vote that I'm discussing now under the tab Top Stories. And once we get the money, the information about the governor's race, you know, the most important race, especially regarding natural gas industry, we're going to put that money to data up there right away.
Well, I mean, for me, if this Marcellus Shale tax, this meager severance tax doesn't go through now, if Corbett is elected, I don't see it ever going through. Because he has taken the anti-tax pledge, even though he's broken it once, but that was just to stick it to working people. I believe he'll stand up for big business, and he'll keep that no-tax pledge. That's just my personal opinion.
Well, he's also, in a way, made it clear through those ads that you cited. I mean, those are very specific ads about how he views natural gas industry in the state. And we've got Ed Riddell, who tried for the past 2.5 years to get a tax through, even though he is very cozy with the industry, and you know he's had three top staffers so far jump ship near the end of his position as governor and head over to work for the natural gas industry. But he still wanted to see a severance tax happen for Pennsylvania.
I think the natural gas
very clear that he doesn't want to.
Right. I think the natural gas industry knows a tax is coming. They just want to get the best deal they can get right now, because I'll tell you, in a year or two down the road, when we're starting to see California-sized budget deficits, there are going to be a lot of people in this state going, hey, they're making a lot of money taking our resource out of the ground. That's a good place to get it from.
Yeah. And now that this bill is passed in the House, we're going to see what happens in the Senate, where it's a more difficult atmosphere.
Right.
Any day that we can get on that, on these concrete votes and do comparisons like that, those will also be up on MarcellusMoney.org whenever we can.
And that's a site we'll put up on our site at TheRickSmithShow.com for our listeners to head over there. Let me ask you this, Alex. You know, you look around. I'm told that if we don't pass this extraction tax, this severance tax, we will be the only state in the country without one. And I was wondering, have you guys done much looking into what other states have done? Like, for instance, I know in Alaska that the oil under the ground is the property of the people of Alaska. It's not the property owners. So when that oil is pulled out of the ground, a tax is given to the state, and the state uses it for its general fund, and then refunds $1,000, $2,000 to every citizen. You know, like, I guess a socialist state, a Sarah Palin state. I'm curious if you've done much looking around the country at other states and how they operate.
When we were putting together that report that we released in May, the Drilling Deep Pockets that you cited, we did a little looking around into severance tax in other states. A nonpartisan nonprofit group called the Penn Budget and Policy Center, which has come to the conclusion that a severance tax is the right thing to do for the state, for an environmental fund, for protection for the taxpayers, to, as you said, give back some of the money that is owed to these companies extracting what is below our feet here, especially companies coming from out of state, from Texas and Oklahoma. And we got a lot of data from them about other taxes around the country, but what's really to remember is the Marcellus Shale is by far the newest and the biggest thing. A lot of oil drilling and gas states out in the West and other shales that have been tapped for many, many years, even decades, they've had severance taxes in place for that long as well. Montana even, I believe, has a severance tax of 15%. Texas has a pretty high one as well. It's really just recent that Marcellus Shale, of course, has come into interest, and they've understood the feasibility of drilling it with horizontal well design and both the profitability as well. And the Marcellus Shale Coalition and the industry is trying to take advantage of the fact that this is a new thing in the East in a way. We've had coal here for so long, but not natural gas. They're trying to say that it's going to hurt their industry and these small companies that aren't going to turn a profit.
you know, as I've said, what I think should happen is we should set a fairly high tax and then incentivize things. Say, okay, you're gonna hire Pennsylvania workers. Here's a carrot. You're going to meet safety requirements. Here's another carrot. I'm a big believer in guiding this industry in a way that's going to benefit we, the members of this, the citizens of this state, or the stockholders of this state, however you want to look at it. But at the end of it, we're going to be the ones who are left here in 50 or 70 years when they've sucked everything out of the ground and have left.
Yeah. Well, I want to be clear, of course, that Common Cause, as a nonpartisan nonprofit, we take no, you know, we take no stance whatsoever on drilling.
Right.
But what is disappointing to us is that the industry is putting so much purposeful money into our election system here in the state, especially a lot of out-of-state companies. And here in a state where it works quite well, as Catherine Klaber, the head of the Marcellus Shale Coalition, their trade group and lobbying group, called Pennsylvania the sweet spot. We have no contribution limits in Pennsylvania, whereas there's shale plays in West Virginia and shale plays in New York that could be profitable, but there are contribution limits there, and there's more regulation.
Right.
There's this problem of a lack of communication between the industry and how they say they're interacting with our elected officials compared with what we actually see when we go digging through the data.
Yep. Again, it's back to the money. And again, if you want to read the piece, it's Deep Drilling, Deep Pockets, The Campaign Contributions and Lobbying Expenditures of the Natural Gas Industry in Pennsylvania by Alex Kaplan. And over, you can get that over at commoncause.org. We'll put a link to our site. Alex, great talking to you, and I look forward to getting those numbers when you're done putting them up.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
Or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody, everybody, let's get into it. Get stoned, get it started, get it started.
Yes. Where's Christine O'Donnell when I need her? Where's Michelle Bachmann? You know, you got to give Crazy credit. You know, and look, I've always loved Crazy. Michelle Bachmann. I think I saw the woman who wrote our next story. Her name is Michelle Borstein, and that automatically thought of Michelle Bachmann. Anyway, she's talking about the Tea Party people, and she said in a new poll that shows half of those who consider themselves Tea Party people also identify as part of the religious right, reflecting the complex and sometimes contradictory blend of bedfellows in the American conservative movement. The poll released Tuesday by the nonprofit Public Religion Research Institute comes as the Tea Party's composition and potential impact is still under hot debate. Now look, as I've been saying for the longest time, these are the same people from all the other failed conservative attempts at movements. These are the delusioned fiscal conservatives that Reagan courted and then promptly screwed. These are the same social conservatives that George H.W. Bush courted and proceeded to screw. These are the same Christian conservatives that little W courted and, of course, screwed. So is it any surprise to us that these fringe types who have been party to this stuff for years? Look, I mean, they've been trying to start their movement. Got to give them credit for that. They've got a vision of what this country is supposed to look like in their eyes. And in their eyes, it's a theocracy where we just decide that this is a Christian nation and that's when the fun begins. And really, I would just love to get it out of the way. So you know what? We are absolutely, without question, unequivocally a Christian nation. So that I could start seeing all the different sects of Christianity eat each other. Because that's when the fun will begin. Because they're the ones that are well-armed. And hopefully it'll be on CNN and on, well, it won't be on Fox, but it'll be on CNN anyway. And you look at Glenn Beck, who, you know, Dana Milbank has an excellent article today out. You know, he's a Mormon. And we know he's a Mormon. And he's out there talking, you know, what I keep saying is in code. It's this dog whistle politic. It's these phrases that people in the know understand. You know, when he said the Constitution's hanging by a thread, you know, that's kind of the same thing that the Mormon leaders were saying years ago. And this theory that they have, this white horse prophecy that they have, that the Constitution will be hanging by the thread, and in will come the, you know, the great Mormons, and they will take over and they will save the nation. And I do believe that Beck thinks of himself as the second coming of Joseph Smith, who is the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or the Mormon Church, however you want to say that. But, you know, that's out there. And, you know, we've actually got a senator who, you know, who's a Mormon, Orrin Hatch. And when Beck and him had a conversation years ago, you know, you got this, last January, the Constitution's hanging by a thread. More code words. More dog whistle politic. Instead of saying, well, you know, I'd like to hear some people. Well, those people. Anyway, back to the study. The percentage of Americans who say that they're part of the Tea Party movement, according to this, is 11%. I've been saying 5%. They say about half the size of the group who say they are part of the religious right or Christian conservative movement. So, you know, half of them. 55% of the people who say they are part of the Tea Party movement agree that America has always been and is currently a Christian nation. 6% more than the self-described Christian conservatives. So even the Tea Party people believe more than the Christian conservatives that this is a Christian nation. And like I said, I'd like to just get it over with. I agree with you. Yes, it's a Christian nation. Let the fighting begin. Anyway, they go on. Among the differences between Christian conservatives and the Tea Parties, there is a source of news with 39% of the former group saying Fox News is the most trusted source for accurate information about politics and current events, while the Tea Twizzlers say 57% get their news from them. Quinnipiac poll last month asked basic demographic information revealed that 20% of the white evangelicals considered themselves part of the Tea Party movement. Again, that's part of the whole Christian conservative movement. Those are the people that they tried to get into this. A Washington Post poll published on Tuesday found more than half of all white evangelicals supported or leaned towards supporting the Tea Party. Interestingly enough, according to the article, the people who want government out of their lives. Now, most of these Tea Party people, they want government out of their lives. Just want, I want a smaller government. I want government out of my life. Well, according to the article, these people showed large swaths of Tea Party people looking for a strong government role in hot-button issues. Nearly two-thirds say abortion should be illegal in all cases, and 45% say that there should be no legal recognition of same-sex couples. It should be interesting, as I'm looking forward, especially on the same-sex marriage thing, because I think the conservative movement is starting to come around to their libertarian roots at some point and saying, well, you know what, I don't want my government doing that kind of stuff. And this is kind of a split in the Republican Party that I think will be one of those fissures that breaks them apart. Because the Democrats are all over the map. If you look at the Democratic ideology, there really isn't a consistency. There's no homogenization. There's just not. They're not a homogenous party. The conservative movement, the Republicans are. They're a lockstep party. When they make their decision, when the leadership makes the decision, it's lockstep. The Democrats aren't like that. But I'm starting to see splinters. Especially if you start seeing people like Rand Paul, you see Miller or O'Donnell or Engel or, Rubio, you see these people end up in the Senate. I think the fissures are going to be greater, and I think the party will come apart. And they're not going to know how to lead. They're not going to know how to get people, how to get consensus. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it would be a good thing. I'm hoping it's not. I don't want to go through the pain and the great suffering that's going to come with a Republican rule in November. Because we do know it's going to be slash and burn. It's going to be pain for 70-75% of us. The 47% of the people who pay no taxes, who pay nothing in taxes, you're on the chopping block. Because they're going to have to raise taxes to balance budgets. And do you think they're going to raise it on the millionaire class? Do you think they're going to raise it on the CEO? No. And then, Tom Corbett here in Pennsylvania, if he wins, he's not going to want to raise taxes. What's he going to do? He's going to raise fees. He's going to raise tolls. He's going to raise licensing fees to pay for things. He's going to raise usury fees. That's what they're going to do. I'm telling you. So get used to it. And then you'll be able to complain even more that you're being taxed enough already. But it's coming. It's absolutely coming. So how do we stop it? Well, we stop it by sane people going, we can't continue down the path that Bush was on. We can't go back to that. No more U-turns. No thumbing it in the wrong direction. We've been down that path, and it's failed us. But what we're going to be talking about is cutting programs like California. Cutting programs for the people who are least able to sustain. Doing things that are, we're going to balance our budgets off the backs of those who are unable to stand. Is that what a Christian nation is? So, I've agreed. Okay, you win. Congratulations. I don't know what you won. There's no prize in your mailbox, but congratulations. I'm going to concede. So now can we take care of each other? Can we now help the poor? Can we now make sure that we have an economy that works? The answer is no. The investor class won't allow it. Can we have trade policy that's going to benefit working people here? No, because the investor class won't allow it. Can we have sane banking regulations that stops the theft of tax dollars and stops this scenario where every 20 years we're bailing out the banking industry because, oh gee, they overextended, and oh gee, they were just a little too speculative, and oh gee, they made risky investments that failed. You know what? If I make a risky investment that fails, I collapse. I'm out on the street. Why does a corporation, why do they get immunity? I don't know. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. Stick around.
two hands are fit to use. I drank my beer in a tavern, sang a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says the challenge to make America's public education system work for all kids can only be met if the whole nation commits to it. At the One Nation March in Washington, D.C., Weingarten said that public school teachers and their unions are committed to achieving the highest quality public education for all.
Every child has a right to a fair and hopeful start in life. Brothers and sisters, we have a choice. We can follow our aspirations, or we can give in to our fears. We here today aspire to our ideals. We here today must invest, not divest, in our kids.
Weingarten urged the public to unite with teachers in a push to improve public education.
We must do it, and I ask you to join America's public school teachers in our quest to make a difference in every child's life. Let's stand together, one nation together.
Legislation approved by the Senate last week will make it easier for federal employees to telework. Jesse Russell explains.
The telework legislation passed by the Senate last week asks agencies to develop policies that would provide employees with opportunities to work remotely, unless they are in a position which makes it a necessity for them to be on site. Under the legislation, each agency will be required to create a telework managing officer position, and that person would be charged with overseeing the telework program. A report from the Office of Personnel Management says that less than 10% of federal workers worked remotely in 2008. Part of the justification for encouraging remote working is that it would help the government continue to function during typically crippling events, such as the snowstorm that brought Washington, D.C. to a standstill in 2009. The legislation will now go back to the House.
The Kohler Company in Wisconsin may become the most recent company to install a two-tiered wage system. Kohler is in contract negotiations with the United Auto Workers and is asking that new employees and workers recalled from layoffs be paid at a rate nearly 35% less than current workers and also not receive health care benefits. The company has also asked union members to accept a five-year wage freeze. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working hard for a quality public school for every student.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire.
Yeah, we'll see it burn. I remember last night we talked about the story in Obion County, Tennessee, where the fire department got a phone call, said, hey, our house is on fire. Oh, my God, the house is on fire. They said, well, let me check our records here. Sorry, family, you didn't pay your subscription this year. We're not coming. In fact, we're not going to tell you we're not coming. Thank you very much. Click, hang up. The wife calls, says, hey, our house is on fire. Please come. So they respond and they say, you know what? Not going to do it. Not going to do it. Not going to put the fire out. We're going to stand here and we are going to watch your house burn to the ground. The husband, he says, I'll pay you anything. Just stop the fire. Just put the fire out. You're here. You got the hoses. You got everything here. Just put the fire out. Nope, not going to do it. So when the fire spreads onto the neighbor's property, they put that out. But for the Kranich family, their house burnt to the ground. So what does the Obion County Budget Committee do? Do they say, you know what, maybe there's a moral hazard here. Maybe we need to rethink our policy. Do you think they did that? Do you think they said, you know, this got us a lot of bad press. We need to maybe rethink the policy. Do you think that happened? No, not at all. What they did last night, they had a meeting, and they've decided to expand the subscription-only fire policy to new towns. ABC 7 there in Tennessee reports that the committee passed an agreement yesterday to give all communities in the county the option of paying a subscription to purchase the fire service, essentially expanding the service that stood by and watched as the Kranich family's home burned to the ground. Union City Fire Chief Kelly Edmondson objected to the new expansion, saying that, quote, the best option is a true fire tax. It eliminates this having 911 or whoever check to say, hey, you're not covered, or hey, you're covered. The last thing a firefighter wants is to not be able to help, he said. According to documents prepared by the county in 2008, the tax would be a 0.13 cent increase in property tax. 0.13 cent. Not 13 cents. Just over a penny increase. And, you know, when I saw this, you know, I said, is this where we want to live? Do we want to live in conservative world where you pay for every service that you need? So every year you have to pay a subscription to the fire department. Every year you got to pay a subscription to the police department. Every year you got to pay a subscription to the people who sweep the streets. Every year you got to pay a subscription to the people who plow the streets. And if you choose to be a free rider, or if, you know what, you just don't have the money, you're going to be left without protection. You're going to be left out in the cold. You're going to be basically ostracized from society. Is that where we want to be as a nation? And I go back to this Christian nation theme. Is this what a Christian nation looks like? Because I've never had anybody be able to explain that to me. You know, I talk to my Tea Party friends and I say, well, okay, let's destroy government. Let's tear it down, blow the bums up, tear them down, whatever you want to do. Get rid of them. They're all gone. There's no more government. You've destroyed it. Congratulations. You've drug it into the bathtub and you have drowned it. Then what? What takes its place? And all I seem to get are platitudes. All I seem to get are liberty, freedom. And exactly what does that mean? Again, Sarah Palin-ish, not very deep. And you look at a story like this, and this comes up every once in a while because there are communities throughout this country that have subscription only. You've got to pay or die. If you don't have the money, shame on you. Nobody's going to help you. And I look at this, and, you know, there's two ways, I guess, of looking at this expansion of the big subscription. One, it's very successful. And then there's the other one that says, hey, we got our example. We got the guy we made an example of. Now it's time to cash in and cash in big, because all those free riders that we've been taking care of for years, we've now made an example of one of them. They're all going to pay now. Personally, I say a small tax, or, you know, in Corbett ease, a small contribution tacked onto your property value, tacked onto your income tax, however you want to do it. But make sure that the service is there for everyone. And it's not based on, do you have the ability to pay? And $75 may not seem like a lot for a year. But what if you don't have it? That was my first question. What if you didn't have the money? Should you now be set apart from everyone else? I got to tell you, a place like that is not a place I want to live. I don't want to live in a place where, you know what, where the least of us are set on an island to suffer. And these people lost their entire homes. And as I said last night, eventually this all comes back to who? It all comes back to we, the taxpayers. It all comes back to we, the consumers, because I'm sure these people had homeowners insurance, and I'm sure that the claim is eventually going to be paid, and we're all going to pay higher rates because of it. But at least this fire department, this small fire department, they made their point. And the conservatives are all a Twitter. Boy, they if you read the blogs and you read some of the defenses of this, this is conservative world. And if this is the world you want to live in, then yes, you should be a conservative. But if you think this is just plain dumb, this is what the conservative movement is about. It's about no government. It's about none of us coming together as a collective and providing for society. It's about how can we profit? How can we make a buck? That's what it's really about. How can we cash in? Now, just like I was talking about education at the beginning of the program. You know, we're in the process of destroying public education. And, you know, I remember as a kid, there were plenty of programs for kids to get involved in. There were tennis programs and soccer and football and baseball. You know, I can't find a summer baseball league in the area for my kids to play in. And I remember as a kid, it didn't cost anything. You know, now you want to sign the kid up, it's $20, $50, $100. You got to do 10, you got to do 2, 3, 4, 5 fundraising drives. We used to fund that stuff with our tax dollars back when the very wealthy were paying part of it. We used to have that kind of stuff. But we kept putting people like Reagan, like Bush, the fiscal conservatives who want to squeeze a quarter until the eagle screams. We kept putting those people in the office, and they kept telling, well, we're watching out. We're making copper wire out of pennies. And what did it get us? What's it gotten us for future generations? You know, and I ask seniors, when your kids were going to school, was it like this? Did you have to worry about the school cutting kindergarten programs? Did you have to worry about them cutting sport programs? No. You didn't worry about that. School was part of the community. But we're doing it. We're in the process of taking the public school out of the community and making it a for-profit interest. And all this talk about charter schools and all this talk about, oh, we need cyber charter and homeschooling. You know what homeschooling is? It's a bunch of overprotective people who don't want their children to experience life. Oh, I want them to be a, you know, good Christian children. Yeah, wait till they go to college. You know, I'll never forget one girl, and I got to be honest, I don't remember her name. She was a PK. She was a preacher's kid. And she had never experienced life. She never had a date. She never went to dances. She never did any of the social things that young girls do as they grow up. And she never walked into it, I guess is the best way of putting it. She never experienced the small things. You know, the little holding hands kind of things. So she had none of that experience going to college. Well, within the first couple of weeks of college, there was a party. And she got drunk, passed out. You know, today we would call it date rape, I think. Who knows what happened. She ended up having sex that night, one way or another, however you want to put it, and couldn't deal with it. And end up killing herself. And the last thing that I've got two daughters. The last thing that I want to do to them is to be that overprotective. And my first instinct is to be, you know, my fatherly instinct is to, you know, somebody look at her cross-eyed, I'll kill you. And all of us have that instinct. But we've got to let our children experience life. You know, it's all this nonsense. Now, well, their kids are bullying. Well, you better get used to it. You better teach your kids how to deal with bullies because they're going to deal with them their entire life. We're not preparing our kids. I just don't think we're doing it right. Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
No pain, no gain, say the fitness folks. But ouch, this old exercise cliche has been badly twisted by many of America's top CEOs who are getting gains from our pains. A new survey finds that corporate chieftains who inflict economic pain on the company's workers receive more financial gain for themselves. The Institute for Policy Studies examined the layoff-payoff records of America's 500 largest corporations during the past couple of years. IPS researchers report that the 50 CEOs who fired the most rank-and-file employees averaged 42% higher pay than their peers, averaging an extra $3.5 million each. One of the champions in this contest of convoluted corporate compensation was Mark Hurd. As chief executive of computer giant Hewlett-Packard, Hurd dumped 6,400 workers in 2009, a year in which he pocketed a paycheck of $24 million. Earlier this year, Hurd was forced to resign from HP after an internal investigation found that he falsified some expense reports. No need to weep for Mark, though. He was comfortably compensated for this bad turn of fortune, receiving a severance package reportedly worth $40 million. Being bad, you see, can be awfully good for a CEO's bottom line. For example, IPS documented one category of badness to goodness that is especially infuriating. Five of the 50 leading pink slip issuers last year were also bailout barons. Among them was Kenneth Chenault, honcho of American Express, which got $3.4 billion from us taxpayers to save it from financial ruin. In gratitude, Chenault subsequently offed 4,000 employees, then helped himself to a paycheck of nearly $17 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, to see the full IPS report, go to ips-dc.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Yes, we can have our tea party with our little fancy cups and the doilies on the little plates and our little pinkies in the air. Oh, how sweet that would be. Oh, the tea party. Oh, the tea party. Maybe Joe the plumber would come. Yes. Is it me or the tea twizzlers really been admiring their press clippings? Are they really buying the press clippings? TPM reported a conservative group in Missouri is picking up the backing of the Tea Party and, of course, Joe the unlicensed plumber in its quest to stop the Humane Society of the United States and other animal rights groups from passing radical anti-puppy legislation. Puppies. And if you've got pictures of your puppies, I love puppies. If you got pictures, send them to me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. We will put them on our wall. And hopefully you didn't get your puppy from a puppy mill. The measure, called Proposition B, or the Puppy Mill Cruelty Prevention Act, is aimed to help eliminate the 3,000 puppy mills in Missouri that constitute 30% of all puppy mills in the United States, according to Michael Markarian. He is the chief operating officer of the Humane Society. The Humane Society, of course, is a national animal rights advocacy group. I don't think it supports your local humane shelters, but they're the big advocacy group. He said the measure that would provide common sense standard for care of the dogs, including sufficient water, sufficient food, clean water, vet care, regular exercise, and adequate rest between breeding cycles. And that measure only applies to commercial dog breeding facilities. That's defined as having more than 10 female dogs who are breeding at any one time for the purpose of you know, selling puppies. You know, if you're gonna supply your local pet store with dogs, I got to tell you, that's part of the puppy mill thing. Seems kind of reasonable to me to say, you know what? We want to make sure that they're fed. We want to make sure that they're well cared for. That you know that the female dogs aren't overbred. Sounds reasonable, right? Kind of. Yeah, I think so. Not to a teabagger, no. In the steps, the Alliance for Truth, I love that name, who are the main fighting force against Proposition B, the Alliance for Truth claims that this is a radical agenda and it's misleading the public with its intention on Proposition B. The society seeks only to raise the costs of breeding dogs and make it even more difficult for little Sally to get a dog of her own. Oh, she's so thoughtful, just so thoughtful. These folks over at the Alliance for Truth. Anita Andrews is her name, and she's the spokesperson for Alliance for Truth. She told TPM that the bill is deceptive, lying bill, that it's trying to purposefully get rid of breeders. The state of Missouri, she said, has been given a bad rap as being called the puppy mill capital of the United States. She said that the Humane Society, they just don't like animals. I'm sure that hurt. That was a real zinger. Of course, I'm sure Obama's behind this as well, you know, because Obama hates puppies. Not only is he a Muslim, a communist, a socialist, fascist, Marxist, he hates puppies. So, yeah. Webster Kirkwood. The Times there in the Webster Kirkwood area quotes this woman, Elaine Cox of Glendale, Missouri. She said, quote, I talked to State Representative Rick Stream there, and he said that many people feel the current laws are enough, and this is just more big government interference. And, you know, I guess there's an accurate claim there. I guess the accurate claim is, you know, that there probably are laws on the books that just are not being enforced. I mean, you've got them there, and there's no money to enforce them. There's nobody there. And I guess what really we should be talking about is this the result of conservative government? Is this the result of starve the beast? Not talking about dogs, but starving the enforcement. If we starve the enforcement, what does it matter if we have laws on the books? We don't have the power. If we don't have the enforcement, we don't have the power to enforce laws already there, and I understand that. From immigration to puppy mills. And look, I find puppy mills just to be disgusting. I mean, you know, really honestly and truthfully, you know, I think you get a dog the old-fashioned way. Someone says, hey, my dog had a couple of puppies. Come get one. We've now made this an industry that we should be profiting from? I don't know. Every dog I've ever gotten, we got the old-fashioned way. Somebody had a puppy, somebody had a couple of puppies and said, hey, we're going to sell a couple of these puppies, we're going to give them away because, you know, the last one we got was a little Rottweiler puppy. A cute little thing. Grew up to be a big dog. Love that dog. But if we are against, you know, puppy mills, that means I might not get another dog ever again, according to the truth people, the truth squad. But the important thing here that I find interesting, and going back to the, you know, these people here in Missouri say there are laws that nobody is enforcing. And I think you can take that across the spectrum. We have immigration laws. We've had them for years. And those immigration laws have had some teeth to them. Problem is, we just don't have anybody to enforce them. Or we selectively enforce them. We don't go after the employers whose jobs are waiting for people here when they get here. We don't go after those folks. And I don't know why we don't do it, other than that we're a greed society. You know, we talk about, you know, this is American. This is America. It's our country. But we don't want to hold employers accountable. We don't want to. See, me personally, I say we make laws so draconian that anyone who hires an undocumented worker, you lose your business. Game over. That's it. No more. You don't get a second chance. And you'll see this stop. It's much like I've always said about prostitution. I say it's the same thing. Don't leave the prostitute alone. Let her go. Just like the judge, you know, the judge who was dealing with the stripper, doing a little toot toot here and a little puff puff there. Leave her go. Get him. And they're going to get him. And it'll be interesting to see what happens to him when he goes to prison. Since he was, after all, someone who was a harsh sentencer. But where do you go? I'm curious. You know, do we let them off? Because we have been. And all I hear from the right is, well, we need to crack down on those illegal immigrants. Get a big bus. Get a big bus, drive around, ship them out of here. What about what draws them here? You're not stopping that. And as long as you've got a border with a poverty-ridden nation, you're always going to have people who are going, gee, those people over there have enough to eat. I think I'd like to have enough to eat. I think I'm going to go over there. So we've got to do something about the poverty in Mexico. And is it our job to do it? No. But it's in our best interest. It's absolutely in our best interest. Because if we don't, they're going to keep coming here. Because there's opportunity here. And as long as they're willing to work for less than we are, and remember, when you got somebody like the guy who's running for Senate in Alaska, Mr. Miller, saying that the minimum wage is unconstitutional, remember that the people who come from Mexico or from Central America, they're willing to work for $1, $2, $3 an hour. You want to see the wage floor fall? Get rid of the minimum wage. Get rid of the safety net. Get rid of the protections that we as a society for the last 70 years have said we wanted. Back when we passed the minimum wage, back when we passed maximum hour laws, back when we passed worker safety laws, back when we did those things that for years prior were unthinkable. The stuff that the guy who's running for Senate in West Virginia would love to go back to, the days of children working in the mines. The days of no safety regulations, the days of liberty of contract, the days of, hey, brother, you're on your own. That's where they want to go back to. We've got a class of modern-day robber barons who want to take us back to the days where there were no controls, where there were no safety nets, where there was a massive desperation class. Do we want to go back to that? And are we headed there anyway? You know, you listen to the doomsdayers, you listen to the people who the sky's falling. You know, they've been saying Social Security's failing for 75 years. It's the end of it. Game's over. This year it's broke. But it keeps paying benefits. I mean, at some point, I do think we've got to face realities. That we're better together than we are divided. And that we need to invest in ourselves, invest in our infrastructure, invest in, oh, I don't know, maybe enforcing laws that are already on the books so you don't have this kind of fight going on like they have in Missouri about puppy mills. Because I don't think anybody, I don't even think the Tea Party people who are fighting the law want to see puppies mistreated. You got to be a pretty sadistic son of a gun to want to see that. But then again, who knows? Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after that. I got no time for living. Yes, I'm working all the time. It seems to me I could live my life a lot better.
making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show. You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now.
Well, we'll see tomorrow. The Supreme Court will hear arguments tomorrow in the case of Snyder v. Phelps. Albert Snyder, he's the father of a Marine killed in Iraq and whose funeral was picketed by the anti-gay fundamentalist nutcase there at the Westboro Baptist Church. I don't even know if you really want to call that a church. I think it's just a bunch of crazy people. But, you know, you've got that. And then on the other side, there's Fred Phelps. And I really, honestly and truthfully, I don't have words to describe what kind of dirtbag this guy is. I really, he's everything that's wrong with religion. And I'm not talking about faith. There's a whole difference between spirituality and your faith and what you believe in and your value structure than organized for-profit business, hey, look at me, mega church, kind of religion. And this guy's one of these, hey, look at me guys. Who's out there to who, whatever the reason, I'm not quite sure, but he's gotten himself into another scrape, and now the Supreme Court's going to decide. And the question here really is one of your speech rights. Do you have the right to say what's on your mind, what you think, what you feel? Do you have the right to say anything versus someone's right not to hear or see whatever it is that you're saying? You know, my grandfather always said, you've got the right to do whatever you want, unless your right infringes on my right, and then we got a problem. And that's this kind of situation, in my view. It's, you know, I think you got the right to do whatever you want, until that ends up on somebody else's plate. And the fact that the location of this person's free speech was at a funeral, to me, adds an interesting component here. And I'm curious what you guys think. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Albert Snyder won a $5 million verdict. against Phelp and his followers at the crazy church there. And it was awarded under duress. But a federal appeals court overturned it on First Amendment grounds. So what's happened now is you've got 14 sets of outside groups who have submitted Friends of the Court briefs to offer their views in this Snyder v. Phelps case. And on one side of the coin, you've got the father of the bereaved, Mr. Snyder, who has, you know, people like everybody in the Senate, Harry Reid. Here's something that Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell can actually agree on, and 40 other members of the Senate. You've got the VFW, the American Legion, the John Marshall Law School, Veterans Legal Support Center. You've got the state of Kansas and 47 other states in the District of Columbia. So you know Phelps, his own state, is lined up against him. And then, you know, siding with Phelps, you've got the ACLU, which, you know, the right has just got to love to go crazy about. But this is a constitutional issue. This is a freedom issue. You've got the Thomas Jefferson Center for Protection of Free Expression. They're another one of the groups. You've got scholars of the First Amendment law, including the University of Missouri and University of Denver. You've got reporters, Committee for Freedom of the Press, and about 20, 25 news organizations. And you've got a whole bunch of other groups that have signed on to this. And then, of course, you've got, you know, some of the groups that couldn't make a decision. They said, you know, I don't know. They're the people who screw up every poll. They're the people who go, I want to participate, but I don't have an opinion. The Anti-Defamation League, the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, and the American Center for Law and Justice, they've all thrown their hat into the I don't know category. But for me, this case is pretty simple. And you do have the right, and I think Mr. Phelps has the right, to say what he wants to say. If, you know, he believes, you know, God hates gay people, God bless you. You know, he has the right to say that. But on the other hand, I think other people have the right to say things back. And as a matter of, you know, I go back to another saying my grandfather, because my grandfather, not being an educated man, had a lot of very good one-liners that were full of wisdom and logic. And he used to say that, you know, sometimes you need to smack somebody upside the head to make a citizen out of them. And there's part of me that says, you know, maybe if somebody would just, you know, give Phelps a good crack upside the head, they'd make a citizen out of him. And while he has the right, in my opinion, to protest even at a funeral, as long as it's on public property, I think he has the right to do it. But on the other side of that coin, if someone takes the stick away from him that the sign is on and beats him with it, I don't know that I got a problem with that. But then again, you get into what speech is then protected. And as vile as this guy is, and as much as I hate the premise that this guy can ruin and destroy a family's final memory of their child, I think we have to defend the right to do it. And I hate that. I really hate that. I really do. But it is, if you believe in the Constitution, you believe in the right of people to have free expression, as cruel and as mean-spirited and as ignorant and stupid as it actually is, I thought what the veterans did was the right thing. You just make a chain around them so nobody can see them and you ignore them. I thought that was the right thing. So I'm kind of interested to see how the court's going to decide this. Because generally, the Supreme Court seems to be breaking on the side of religious freedom, so to speak, and blurring the line between church and state. So I'm not really sure. It will be very, very interesting to see where this goes in the coming in the coming days, and it'll probably take a month or two, to come up with their decision. But still, I'm interested. And there are a couple other cases that are interesting as well. This case on whether corporations have privacy rights. You know, they're telling us that we don't have privacy rights. When we're walking around in public, people can take pictures of us and take videos of us and you know, do a lot of things that I don't particularly like. But the question is, do corporations now have privacy rights? Do they have the right to say that, you know, hey, that's our information and we're not going to give it up, to tell the government no? I'm interested to see how that goes as well. A little bit lighter story, something kind of cutesy and nice. Ben Wolf is a little nervous, writes the article from Tunbridge, Vermont. He admits it as he stands waiting one recent afternoon in a farm in central Vermont. His apprehension had nothing to do with farming and everything to do with meeting someone new. He was participating in an event called Weed Dating. It's a meetup for single farmers. Since I thought that there are a lot of farms in this area, it'd be interesting to see if we can get some weed dating around here to help single farmers find themselves a mate or a date or, I don't know, someone to play with. They say it's a variation of speed dating, or I guess for a couple minutes you weed together and you talk, and who knows, maybe you make a new friend. The woman who came up with it said, you know, we've been watching. We have this one young guy who works for us, and he's single and lives in Chelsea. And we were joking that there were not a lot of young single people around here, so we came up with the idea of weed dating. And, you know, congratulations, you can have that, as far as I'm concerned. It should help out with the farming. And look, you may keep families involved in farming, which I think we need to go back to. I would love to see more family farms. I would love to see the state government get into helping families who want to go back into farming get back into it. It disgusts me to see what has happened to the farming industry. The fact that we've got these mega farms, these industrial farms with their Terminator seeds, and that's not the way things are supposed to be. Anyway, I want to take a quick break right here. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
United we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell we fight?
In the future, I do think we're going to be fighting over water. I think that's the resource that we will be fighting over the most, especially as we allow our water supply to be polluted. And if you look at the BBC's report, Richard Black writes about 80% of the world's population lives in areas where fresh water supply is not secure. Researchers compiled a composite index of water threats that includes issues such as scarcity and pollution. The most severe threat category encompasses 3.4 billion people. Writing in the journal Nature, they say that Western countries conserving water for people through reservoirs and dams works for people but not nature. They urge developing countries not to follow the same path. Look, you know, you look right here in this country, down in Georgia, Florida, Alabama, in that area, they were about ready to go to war with each other, literally sending their National Guards after each other over Lake Lanier because Atlanta was taking more water than they had agreed to because their population is growing. There's a need for fresh drinking water. You look over, you know, the Colorado River going from, you know, Colorado into California and through Arizona there. And the reality is there's not enough water. And even right here, at the rate we're seeing pollution, you know, where I grew up in Cleveland, there was talk that they wanted to actually put radioactive waste in the salt mines under the lake. Think about that for a second. You know, that's one of the world's largest supplies of fresh water. And if we don't have fresh water, we don't survive. We don't survive. We don't have to worry about oil. We don't have to worry about natural gas. And this is what bothers me about the drilling. This is what bothers me about not having in place secure regulations on how this stuff is going to be extracted. We let them start before they had the rules of the game. So they came in and said, well, we're going to do what we want to do. What's that going to do to our water supply? When you look at the movie Gasland, you know, guy turns on his faucet, lights his water on fire because there's methane coming through the pipes. What are we doing to ourselves? And once we pollute the waterway, it takes time, it takes years to clear up. You know, they're talking down in the Louisiana area that it may never clear up. All the oil that was spewed into the Gulf there, all the oil that got into the marshes may never get out of the environment. That the fish is actually toxic to eat. That's not good for a fishing economy there either. But I worry about right here in our backyard. I worry about this drilling. And I worry about having safe drinking water. Yeah, you look at in West Virginia, you know, Manchin saying, you know what, Governor Manchin saying, you know, we'll find out tomorrow if he's going to actually sue the EPA to allow them to continue mountaintop removal. And some of the things that I've seen through this book that my good friend Bob gave me, you go, is this what we do to our planet so that we can have a little bit of income? You know, the coal that they pull out of it, and, you know, it was during the break, you know, my producer said, look, you know, you forgot to mention one clear fact. The coal that they pull out of the ground in West Virginia, They don't sell in West Virginia. Most of that stuff goes to China. So we're raping our environment so we can power the Chinese economy. You know, how much of the natural gas? And I'm hoping that natural gas will be abundant and cheap so that we can heat our homes here. But you look at West Virginia, you know, that coal doesn't stay there. It would be nice if it did. Maybe some of the wealth would trickle down to the people who actually dug it up. Instead, what they get is black lung. What they get is an accident every couple of months. What they get is a CEO who said, well, you know what? We run coal here. We don't worry about safety. No, don't worry about that. We just run coal because coal pays the bills. Again, I ask you, is this where we want to be? Is this the world that we want to live in? And I say no. But I'm telling you, as sure as I'm sitting here, if Tom Corbett or people like Pat Toomey or people like Christine O'Donnell or Sharon Angle or Miller or any of these, Rand Paul, any of these people take over, we're going back, baby. We're going back to the Lochner era. We're going back to the days where child labor was legal, where maximum hour laws were illegal, where worker safety was something that, well, you know, good luck, you're on your own, brother. We're going back to a Supreme Court that sides with business at every opportunity. And maybe, you know, I've often said maybe it'll be a good thing. You know, going back to the old saying, you know, when your stomach's empty, maybe your head gets right. You know, maybe we need that cleansing. Maybe we need to learn the lessons that our great grandparents learned. Maybe we can't read it in a book. Because maybe our history has been so badly skewed. Maybe it's been rewritten and rewritten and edited to the point to where nobody agrees on what it was. And we just have to learn for ourselves firsthand. Maybe that's what it's got to be. I remember my great-grandmother telling me stories about the Depression and how hard it was on them. And had it not been for the WPA, how the family could have starved because my great-grandfather was able to get work. And, he, you know, the thing is he was an electrician by trade and had a very difficult time during the Depression getting a job until Roosevelt said, you know, we're going to start building stuff. We need electricians to build things. We need plumbers to put plumbing in. We need masons. We need bricklayers. We need all these things, which is what we should be doing now. We've got infrastructure needs that have been too long neglected. We've got needs in this country that for too long have been neglected. And all we keep hearing from the right is, well, you know, the consumer is sacrosanct. He spends his money much more efficiently than the government could ever do. When was the last time you saw somebody build a bridge? I've never seen a tax cut build a bridge. When was the last time you saw somebody say, you know what, I'm gonna build a school today? If we go back to the robber baron era, like we seem to be, with the inequity in this country, the wealth divide between those who have and those who don't, at epic proportions, I'm in favor of going back to a massive tax and saying, you know what, like the great Andrew Carnegie, like the Vanderbilts, like the Mellons. Okay, top tax rate or you build stuff. One way or another, we need the wealthy in this country. We need the large corporations in this country to step forward and do what we've given them resources to do. And not hold us hostage, because that's what they're doing right now. The messaging is right now they're going to hold us hostage. Because they never wanted Obama to succeed. They never wanted this economy to turn around. It was a perfect opportunity for them. A perfect opportunity. And they're taking full advantage of it. And they're going to put their hacks back into place who are going to continue down the path of deregulation. You know, can you show me a deregulation scheme that's worked? because I can't find one. For a short term, they worked out pretty well while we lived off the resource that we built. I mean, the airline is a perfect example of that. While we were living off the investment of the airline that the airlines had made, while they lived off of that, things were okay. Now that they got to start buying new planes and start fixing things and start doing the things they should have been doing all along, now you're starting to feel the pain. Now you're starting to see the prices go up. You know, the trucking industry is the same thing. We deregulated the trucking industry. Did the prices go down? For trucking, they did. Not at the shelf, they didn't. The only thing that ended up happening is the shippers and the brokers ended up pocketing all the money, and the drivers got screwed, and the consumers got nothing. So how did that work out? Well, it worked out that you made a class of poverty workers. You've got a bunch of people driving around in sweatshops. You know, a bunch of you guys driving up and down the road right now. Tell me how the sweatshop's going for you. I drove a truck for a number of years myself. The difference is I was fortunate. I was fortunate to have a union card. And I say every truck driver should have a union card and be paid a decent living wage and be able to spend time with their families. You know, I've had big riggers tell me, oh, I've been home 5 days this year. I've been home 3 days in a year. Is that the world you want to live in? I don't think so. It's not the world that I want to live in. Not one bit. And when you look at the fact that, you know, FedEx and UPS, they jumped their rates almost 6%. Is that going to equate to raises for their workers? Maybe for the unionized UPS, I can guarantee you, not for FedEx. FedEx was one of those companies that right when the recession hit, they went in and got their pound of flesh, dropped wages back. So as the rates go up, do you really think the wages will go up with it? No. At some point, we got to fight back, folks. And we only do that if we can stand together. And if we can agree that, you know, we're not going to agree on every issue. But the big stuff, the important stuff, how we're going to feed our families, what kind of an economy we want to have, what kind of trade policies we should have, the kitchen table stuff, the economic stuff. I think we all agree on that. And the polls have bared that out. The polls have shown that we agree. We'd love to have things made in America. I would love this country to be independent. That's the only way you're going to have true strength, is that if you're able to produce what you need and you're able to pay for what you need. We've been sold a false bill of goods, folks. We have absolutely been sold a false bill of goods by the right. And they've played to our worst tendencies, which is that we're smarter than anybody else. We're exceptional. And I've had people ask me, well, don't you believe America's exceptional? I believe we have an exceptional opportunity. I believe we can, if we put our mind to it, be exceptional. But by birthright, no, we're not exceptional. We're just like anybody else. We won the birth lottery. We were born in this country. What we do with that from here and how we treat each other from here defines who and what we are. It's that simple, folks. So, again, thanks for everybody who's listening tonight. Again, you can go to our website at thericksmithshow.com if you missed the program. You can take a look at it on our web stream. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails and occasionally use a couple of them here on the show. Again, have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Rick Smith Show.